So, hi Krishna. So, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me to come here and be in your association for a few days. I'm very honored. I've been looking forward to it. The Slovenian Yatra is, known in Europe for being a very nice Yatra with a good number of devotees and a lot of things going on. And also just the fact that we are very few tonight is also good in one sense, because that shows that devotees here, they are going out and having programs. And I think Prabhupada say, we cannot just stay in the temples and expect everyone to come here. We have to go out and meet, people, meet devotees and like that. So, I'm happy to be here so far. So, I'll try to give a presentation that I've actually given many times before, and which actually it's more than 10 years old. So if I made a new presentation, I would make basically the same, but I could also add some new material. But nothing that in any way changes the conclusions or anything like that. Nothing has happened over the last 10 years that has changed, rather.
No new species. No appeared.
No, not that I mean, they might claim that, but they've been claiming that for the last 150 years, and it's doubtful that any new species have arisen over or been observed. But in one sense, that's really beside the point. Darwin's evolution theory is not really. What we are criticizing is it's not really about whether species can arise or whether existing species are fixed or not. That's a side point. It's a different, the issue is really a different thing, which I'll get to. But I call this the life comes from life revisited, back to the old life comes from life, which I assume that you're familiar with, everyone. Prabhupada had some conversations, some morning walks in 1973, which later came out as a book, where he was discussing mainly with his disciple Srub Damra Maharaj, who was also a professor of chemistry, Professor Todam Singh, where Prabhupada is addressing a representative of the modern materialistic scientific community. Of course, Srub Damra Maharaj is not a materialistic scientist, but he plays the role where they say that life can arise from chemistry. And Prabhupada said, if that's true, then can you go to your laboratory and create life with your chemicals? And if not, then it's not science. We want a demonstration. We can see readily that life comes from life. So that's more rational, that the original cause is life and not matter. But and so that was Prabhupada's overall argument. And at that time, Prabhupada, he requested his science-minded devotees to address this issue, that that they claim that you can explain life without a creator, without God. And he gave arguments, and actually they Prabhupada's arguments are right on, and they can defeat any other argument, actually. But they're not expressed or put in like scientific jargon or terms, and therefore he wanted it, also the arguments presented in scientific technical language and presentation. So that was a mission that he gave to his science-minded devotees. And devotees did that. Discussing, researching, and writing on this up through the 70s and 80s and so on. When I came first, I got immediately, because I have some kind of a semi-science background. Never completed anything, but I was kind of, very much affected by modern scientific way of thinking. So for me it meant a lot that devotees were addressing these issues and actually showing no Krishna consciousness is also can be supported in a scientific way, and that these ideas that life can be explained purely in material terms, chemical, physical terms, actually they're not really scientific. So it meant a lot for me. And and for my, you could say, my faith in Krishna consciousness, which should not be blind. We are not meant to have blind faith, and we neither can we have blind faith. It's not a possibility, really. You don't function like that. We need rational, you can say, scientific reasons to accept something as our faith. So, but then in something in the end of the 90s, I started wondering, why isn't there more science coming out from, you know, our devotee sciences? Because actually for many years we hadn't got new books out. So then I started myself getting into it and reading scientists, the kind of the upcoming intelligent design scientists who became very very prominent also in, you know, and still they still are. Because at that time they were becoming known, and I started reading all you know, a lot of their material and books and so on. I started corresponding with several of them. I met some of them and got to know them quite well, and started myself lecturing, giving presentation to devotees, also to outside audiences. And then in 2007, I started working with the BBT and Brahma Muhurta, whom I'm sure you know Brahma Muhurta. Everyone knows him. And he agreed that we should publish a book, which became, you know, we have it over here, called Rethinking Darwin, which is the latest. Like this came out, BBT book, which gave the latest science and the latest updated arguments that can be made against on Darwin evolution and intelligent design and so on. So this has given me a chance to give this presentation and work with this in many ways, in many contexts, with both with devotees but also in many other outside engagements. I've been involved with that. So it is clear that Prabhupada, he wanted us to deal with this. Here is a quote. It's from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada, he writes in a purport, "A person who always desires to serve Krishna is interested in ways to convince people that there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead and that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Krishna. That is his ambition." So so I guess it's obvious when you come to a high Krishna temple, devotees will tell you that God is Krishna, or Krishna is God. And that is definitely, you know, we want to convince people about that, that Krishna is God. But but what do you do when someone say, that's nice, but I don't think God is there. You know, why should I believe there is a God? So then how can you convince anyone about that Krishna is God? So then it's also as much a duty, an ambition of a devotee to also convince people, first of all, that actually God does exist. And once they're convinced about that, well, then we can talk about who is God, and then we will say, well, Krishna is God. So convincing ourselves that God exists is also part of our mission. It's as much as, you know, telling them who the Supreme Personality of Godhead actually is. So in this context, Prabhupada was very much asking us to address, of all scientists, because there are so many scientists, but he asked us to address the issue of Charles Darwin's and his theories. And here I have a couple of quotes on that. This is from May the 3rd, 1973. And Prabhupada says here, "Because they are standing on a wrong theory, all their calculations are wrong, and people are suffering. The rascal Darwin's theory, this foolish theory, wrong conception of life. So we have to challenge, protest, defeat. This will be our work. Otherwise, it will be misleading this society. We have to stop this misleading. Another quote. Scientists and people after this so-called scientist, Darwin, we want to stop this misleading. That is our duty. So, of course, we might think, or someone might say, Prabhupada, he just has some kind of phobia about Darwin. Why, you know, there's so many scientists, and maybe because, you know, he was British and Prabhupada didn't like the British, But no, Darwin is very unique amongst scientists. Here is a quote from a very famous evolutionary biologist, Ernst Mayr, who said in 1999 that no biologist has been responsible for more and for more drastic modification of the average person's worldview than Charles Darwin. Professor Mayr, he gave the example of someone like Einstein, who certainly was an outstanding scientist, and he changed the world of science and physics. But whether Einstein's ideas had any influence on the average person's worldview and life and so on is doubtful. But Darwin had. He changed the worldview in the, you know, amongst everyone, and with enormous implications in, you know, in history. Actually, there was a world before Darwin. There was a world after Darwin, and he really changed history because ideas have power. You know, ideas have very great power. Someone wrote that one man once wrote a book, and some laughed at that. And those who laughed, their skins became the binding for the second edition of the book. You get that point? No, you didn't. You know, so someone wrote a book, and there was, and people were laughing. This is just a book. But those who laughed, actually, they were killed, and their skin was made into leather, and they bound the books for the second edition. That was actually about Rousseau. His ideas caused the French Revolution. Similarly, Darwin, he brought some ideas, and a lot of things happened. It's doubtful, I think, that, for example, the First and Second World Wars would have happened without Darwin's ideas being spread. Of course, I don't know, but you know, ideas have consequences. What was the main, what was the real thing that Darwin, he changed in the worldview? Here is another prominent scientist who stated this, Professor Ayala, American biologist. Darwin's greatest accomplishment was to show that the complex order and function in living creatures can be explained as a natural result, as a result of a natural process, natural selection, without having to refer to a creator or some other external factor. So that's basically what Darwin he said. You don't need God. You don't need a creator to explain the wonder of life. It can all be explained naturally. Naturally means with chemistry, with physics, with chance, and there's no reason to think that there is a creator behind life. It can all be explained in a material way. That's really what Darwin he did. So Darwin actually made people atheists. His theory is an atheistic theory, and accepting that also makes people atheists. So that's really what it's about. Some would say in a scientific discussion you cannot discuss the existence of God, whether God exists or not. That doesn't belong to a scientific discussion. Well, okay, if that's true, then Darwin does not belong to a scientific discussion, because this is what he's discussing. Really, that's the underlying theme. Can you explain life with just pure material causes? And he claims you don't need a creator, but then you have to introduce the idea of a creator to argue that you don't need him. And if you're in a scientific context can argue you don't need a creator, then you can also argue that there might be some observations, scientific observations, that actually points to the fact that you might need intelligent creator behind life. It all depends on, you know, the scientific observations. So, and what is interesting is that actually before Darwin, scientists, they were all claiming, basically all of them, that actually, yes, life is too complex and universe is too complex to explain without having referring to a creator. There's sometimes the idea that science and religion has always been opposed to each other. There's been a war between science and religion always, and like that. But that is actually simply not historically correct. That's not correct. Actually, scientists were, up until Darwin, basically they were religious and theists. They may not have been. They may have been philosophically theists, and some were also really strong Christians, for example. But they were all saying that, like, you know, you cannot explain life without having, or nature or universe, without pointing to a creator behind it. For example, this is a quote from Isaac Newton, from his most famous Principia, maybe the most important scientific book ever written. It's a book where Newton introduces his laws of motion and gravity and, you know, calculation of planetary orbits and so on. It's a book packed with mathematical formulas and so on. And in the middle of that, you find this quote: "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Newton, he concluded that, well, you can explain how the planets in the solar system are moving, orbiting around each other with his laws of motion, but you cannot explain how they got in that place to begin with. That seems to be an arrangement. Here is another quote from von Linné, or Carolus Linnaeus. Someone knows him? You know him? Yeah. He's probably the most important biologist in modern time. I mean, he lived in 1700. He was Swedish. He's the one who introduced the classification system of biology. Like, for example, you know that, like, humans, we are known as Homo sapiens. All species are classified by two Latin names. And this system was introduced by Linné or Linnaeus. Linné is actually his Swedish name. Linnaeus is what he's known as in English. So he was extremely significant biologist. And he has a quote from him: "I saw the infinite, all-knowing, and omnipotent God. I followed his footprints over the fields of nature and saw everywhere an eternal wisdom, a power, an inscrutable perfection." Here's a quote from another. He was also a really big Professor Agassiz. He was a professor at Harvard, but he was actually Swiss originally. And in his time, in the 1800s, he was one of the really top scientists in the world. And he wrote, this is 1857. This is very interesting because Darwin only 2 years later published his book, which changes everything. So this is just up to the time before Darwin's Origin of Species comes out. And Professor Agassiz wrote here: "The living world shows also premeditation, wisdom, greatness, prescience, omniscience, providence. Natural history must, in good time, become the analysis of the thoughts of the Creator of the universe as manifested in the animal and vegetable kingdoms as well as in the inorganic world." So Professor Agassiz says that the goal of science, natural history, biology, is to actually understand the mind of God. So you tell the modern scientists that, but that's, you know, that. And that's not controversial. It wasn't controversial at all. That was standard, mainstream. Again, that changed. Just 2 years later, Charles Darwin published his On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, where he claims several things. He claims several things. One of his claims is: "I view all beings not as special creations, but as lineal descendants of some few beings." Here, special creation means it's the idea that all species are created separately. That's called special creation, and that was the general idea. I mean, there were other scientists before Darwin who played with the idea and argued that there is some evolution or transmutation, it is growing, that species were changing into other species. But generally, most biologists accept at least some level of special creation, that many species must have been created separately. But here, Darwin argues that actually all living forms, they originate back to one original life form. That, as I said, of some few beings, but really to one original common ancestor. This is uniquely Darwin. And he wrote also, in the origin of species, I had two express purposes in mind. First, to show that species had not been separately created, and second, that natural selection had been the most important cause of change. Darwin, here the word natural selection is a key word. Natural selection is not just selection as we understand, but Darwin by this refers to purely natural processes. Some might have the idea and argue this: there is an evolution, but it's God's way of creating and unfolding a plan for living beings in this world. But this is not what Darwin is arguing for. He's arguing for that it only happens by natural processes, and this is really the big one. This is what should be addressed, and that at least this is what I'm arguing against, or trying looking at whether species are changing or not. That's a separate thing, even if they have a common ancestor. But can everything be explained completely by natural processes, by chemistry and physics again? But at least this is, to sum up again, Professor Ayala said that was Darwin's greatest accomplishment. He showed that you can actually explain everything in living creatures as a result of a natural process, without a creator, without God. So says Francisco Ayala. But of course, there's one thing that if one knows a little bit about biology and history of the idea of evolution and so on, not everything is right about this statement. And what is wrong is that Darwin's theory that he proposed in Origin of Species was tested by scientists at his time, and it was shown to be false. It was rejected, and all evolutionists nowadays, all scientists nowadays, are not really Darwinists. They're neo Darwinists. That means they actually have a different theory. And this is new, but it's a standard. Some scientists are not even aware about this distinction. But there are two clearly different theories. Neo-Darwinian theory is a different theory than Darwin's original theory. And since Darwin's theory was shown to be wrong, then how can Professor Ayala say that Darwin showed that you can explain living creatures without a creator when his theory was rejected? So Darwin did not show it. Darwin did not show it. He showed you can argue it, and you can get away with it. But he didn't actually, scientifically, he did not show it. It's interesting to, let's have a little look at what was wrong with Darwin's original theory, because it also gives us a good insight into the thinking of evolution, and even some evolutionists are not aware of this, and they still argue these wrong concepts that Darwin he introduced in 1859. So his first mistake was to claim that species are endlessly mutable. Species can change unlimitedly, and through breeding, races or sorts may become new species. Breeding, breeding on animals, breeding on plants. Many changes can happen. And Darwin claims, here is an example, "Nevertheless, according to my view, varieties are species in the process of formation or are, as I have called them, incipient species." You understand what he, not completely.
Incipient.
Incipient means beginning. Uh-huh. They're kind of, you know, like a seed that is just sprouting is an incipient plant. It is about to become full grown plant. But I mean, in one sense, it seems reasonable, because if you look at breeding, what we can do by breeding, for example, dogs. We all, you know, how many dogs are there? They actually all are resulted of breeding from one original individual or something like that. Wolves, many think they actually wolves are, you know, dogs are just wolves bred into many species of dogs. And how different dogs they are. They are, you know, you have tiny, tiny, you know, what called chihuahuas, then that are just not, you know, like big rats. And then you have Great Danes, you know, I'm not saying because I'm Danish, but it's just, they're the biggest dogs. They like small cows. And all kinds of varieties of dogs in between, of all kinds of colors and fur and sounds and smells, and you get dogs in all kinds of varieties. And this is just on breeding for a few hundred or thousand years. Just imagine if you can, you know, breeding goes on for millions of years, and you know, anything can happen. Seems plausible. That's basically the argument. You keep on breeding, and ultimately you get completely new species. So, but although this seems reasonable, it turns out this is not happening. And Darwin actually himself should have known that, because breeding is not something that was invented after Darwin's time. Humans have been breeding for thousands of years on plants and animals. And breeders can tell you that breeding has its limits. For example, here's a quote from a breeder. Luther Burbank was a famous plant breeder just after the time of Darwin. And he wrote, "I know from experience that I can develop a plum half an inch long or 1 2.5 inches long with every possible length in between. But I'm willing to admit that it is hopeless to try to get a plum the size of a small pea or one as big as a grapefruit. I have roses that bloom pretty steadily for 6 months of the year, but I have none that will bloom 12, and I will not have. In short, there are limits to the development possible." And that has been observed by all breeders. You can only push it to a certain limit. And you don't create new functions or new organs either. You simply adjust what is already there in terms of sizes and so on. But you cannot create something that is not there already by breeding. And that's also why, you know, breeding with dogs, but they're still dogs. Even though they are so, you know, the difference is so, you know, again, Great Dane and a small poodle or chihuahua. You know, if for example, a few million years from now, someone starts digging for fossils and they find a Great Dane and a small chihuahua, probably wouldn't know. They'll think they're different species, but they're not. they are the same species. So all dogs are still the same species. They are not changed, and that's what breeding shows. And it shows there are limits. So Darwin was wrong there, and actually he should have known that. But he was hoping that it would, you know, that he could get away with that. Or basically, the other thing that where Darwin was wrong was the idea that acquired traits are inherited. I'll give you a quote so you'll get a better idea what's meant by acquired traits. "The great and inherited development of the udders in cows and goats in countries where they are habitually milked in comparison with the state of these organs in other countries is another instance of the effect of use that causes changes in the organisms." Another quote. "From the facts alluded to in the first chapter, I think there can be little doubt that use in our domestic animals strengthens and enlarges certain parts, and disuse diminishes them, and that such modifications are inherited." You understand what he means? It means, you know, we can do something that can change an organism, body, or like myself. You know, I can go to, you know, some physical exercise, bodybuilding, and I can get big, big, strong muscles instead of being weakling as I am right now, but I can become big, strong. And then Dharma's claim is, then my children will become have strong muscles. Is that going on? That's not happening. I mean, we can do anything to this body. It does not affect the inherited material we pass on to the next generation. So many examples show that. For example, there are places in the world where women, in order to look more beautiful, they make their, for example, ears or lips bigger by hanging weights in them, so they have enormous ears and they have big lips and they look really beautiful. But girls born in those cultures by these women, are they born with bigger ears and bigger lips? They're born like girls everywhere, like everywhere else. Or we can, for example, you know, we are, you know, pale Europeans, especially in this time of the year. So if we move somewhere else where it's always sunny and shiny, and we become, you know, brown and sunburned and tanny and like that, will our children be born with darker skin? No, doesn't happen. This idea is wrong. Darwin is completely wrong on this. He was, in one sense, excused because the laws of inheritance were not known in his time. They were discovered actually at the same time, but it became only known a little, a few decades later. Gregor Mendel, you must know Gregor Mendel because he's just from around the corner, from Austria. Monk, actually monk in a Catholic monastery in Austria, he made experiments with plants, with peas, and actually showed that, you know, inheritance means you're simply mixing traits that are already there, but you're not creating something new. It's like if you have a deck of cards, you know, and someone plays card here? Mm-hmm. Hope not, because it's against our regulatory principles. But you have a set of, take a card, and you can mix them, and then you give out cards. So you can mix, you can get different hands. But it's not that by mixing them, new cards arise. Suddenly you sit with a card that's never been there before. That was Darwin's idea. But the real fact is that, like for example, when, in, you know, we're mainly talking about sexual propagation, men and women, their chromosomes are mixed. So you get, you know, new mixtures, but no new traits arise in that process. So, because the real problem here with Darwin's theory, again, is not how species are selected and, you know, the survival of the fittest like that. That is how do new traits arise to begin with that selection can work on. And that this was Darwin's idea, that you use of organs cause changes of organisms that is passed on to the next generation. So that was shown to be wrong. Therefore, Darwinism is actually rejected, and already in 1875 it was clear that this theory is not right. So just to sum up, that was the idea that species are endlessly mutable, external influences and use of organs create new genetic material, acquired traits are inherited. Darwin's theory was rejected around 1875. Those who believe they believe in Darwin, in fact, don't. And many people believe they believe in Darwin, but they don't know. No, it's not, they don't believe in Darwin, they believe in neo-Darwinism. And what is neo-Darwinism then? That's the idea that genetic mutations create new genes which ultimately give rise to new species in otherwise stable species. Here you see the word mutation. This is not Darwin. Darwin doesn't use it. Many think Darwin used the word mutation, but he didn't. It's not. It's a later word that comes. Because it was discovered that species, you know, are stable and they don't change by Mendel. But then it was discovered. But they change sometimes anyway. So what's going on? And these changes, they were called freaks of nature, and then and later on they were called mutations. And in the 1950s, it was actually discovered that that's what goes on is that the DNA inside the cell in the chromosomes, when that is being copied, they're being copied as they are, but sometimes there's a small copying mistake. And these copying mistakes, they are mutations. So you can follow? So that's interesting. So then our next question is, of course, can that be the explanation for how new species arrive through evolution? And that is a discussion now. There are those who think that actually it cannot be the complete explanation. Mutations happen. No, nobody is doubting that there are mutations going on. That can be observed, and we have plenty of mutations even in our bodies, which are pretty harmless, and we might even have some mutations which are causing some disease or deficiency in our bodies. Actually, doctors, medical doctors, they have, you know, books, volumes of books that describe all kinds of diseases which are caused by mutation from your parents or passed down in the line of your ancestors. And that's what really the point, that most mutations that are observed either have a harmless or they are causing damage to the body. But favorable mutations, they are rare. They're actually quite rare. You can find examples of bacteria becoming resistant to antibiotics. That happens by mutations. So you can say that's favorable. Or there's one instance. This is malaria parasite. So this is an example with malaria. It's actually an example of humans having a mutation that causes them to have a disease called sickle cell anemia. Anyone knows what that is, that means? Huh? Sickle cell anemia. Anemia is a disease in the blood, and sickle cell. Sickle is the old tool that you use for cutting grains. It has a shape like a half moon. Blood cells are normally spherical, round globes. But those who have this disease, their blood cells have shapes like half moons. And this is due to a mutation. And what's interesting is that it's counted as a favorable mutation, although that 25% of those who have the mutation, they die. So then you say, how can it be favorable? Well, it turns out that those who have sickle cell anemia, they are immune to malaria. Malaria is caused by a parasite. The parasite cannot attack those who have sickle cell anemia. So in places in the world where malaria is widespread, then even though 25% of those who have sickle cell anemia die, but 40% of the rest of the population are killed by malaria, so then it's an advantage to have sickle cell anemia. So that's given as a favorable mutation example of that. But what mutations can or do otherwise seems to be quite limited. For example, again, malaria. Here is a map of malaria, where we find malaria. Different strains of malaria are found, as you can see, and as I'm sure you know, it's a tropical disease. It's found in the tropics. And you can ask, why is that? Well, it turns out that the parasites cannot survive and they cannot propagate if the temperature goes beyond something like 16.5 degrees centigrade. Then they die out. Of course, when the parasites live in the human body, because we warm-blooded, that's not a problem. But when they've been transferred from one human to another by mosquito, then the temperature, if that drops below 6.5 degrees, then they die out. So that's why you don't find malaria, for example, here. And then you can ask, how is it that malaria parasites have not developed tolerance to lower temperatures, because they seem to have had plenty of opportunity. The last 10,000 years, there have been more malaria parasites, both individuals and in generations, than there have been mammals for the last 150 million years. You know, mammals, we mammals, all, yeah. And according to the theory of evolution, to new Darwinian theory, all mammals arose from a single original mammal, a small rodent-like, rat-like creature, which then became all the different mammals of whales and elephants and bats and giraffes and humans and so on. So many different mammals. So such a great variety could arise over 100 million years through mutations. How can it be that these parasites cannot just develop tolerance to lower temperatures through mutations? But it turns out that if they were to develop tolerance to lower temperatures, more mutations would have to happen simultaneously. That is unlikely to ever happen, even with a staggering number of individuals or parasites. Which also puts a big question mark about the power of mutations to cause much change at all. Because this idea that mammals arose from mutation has not been observed. It's just kind of it's just a proposal or even a belief. And, you know, so you can make arguments like that, that seems mutations are also very limited in what they can accomplish. And actually, the problems are so widespread that, you know, there are scientists who are openly proclaiming that we have to make more research on this. For example, you can go on a website. It's called descentfromdarwin.org. And there's a statement. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. This statement has been signed now by 1,000 scientists. You can also, if you're a scientist, you can also go and put your name on it if you want. If you have a PhD in one of the, you know, you have in so-called hard science, physics, chemistry, biology, biochemistry, mathematics, geology, like that, then you can put your name on there if you have a PhD. And 1,000 scientists have done that, and you can go and read it for yourself. And the problem is actually so pronounced and so obvious that in 2008, the Konrad Lorenz Institute in Austria invited to a conference, they invited 16 of the world's leading biologists to what they call toward an extended evolutionary synthesis. And the topic of the conference was explained in the invitation that they sent out to the scientists. Here I quote from there. Not only we have witnessed the molecular revolution from the discovery of the structure of DNA to the genomic era, we are also grappling with the increasing feeling that we just don't have the theoretical and analytical tools necessary to make sense of the bewildering diversity and complexity of living organisms. I'll just take out this. I mean, this was from the same, just to point out, emphasize again. We just don't have the theoretical tools necessary to make sense of the complexity of living organisms. And, or they could even put it more simple, we don't have a theory that can explain the complexity of living organisms. It's interesting, actually, I gave the quote from Professor Ayala, who said Darwin was able to explain how you could have the complexity of living organisms. But here you have scientists who are saying the very opposite. We don't have a theory that can explain the complexity of living organisms. And what has happened is, you know, what they are addressing here is actually the amazing complexity that have been discovered over the last 50 years and more. Of the complexity of cells, Here we talk about biochemistry and molecular biology. Darwin thought a cell was something very, very simple and didn't need much explanation. Because his time, the microscopes were pretty crude. You could see cell, you could see the nucleus in the cell. That was basically it. So he thought it was some kind of a microscopic drop of some slime or mucus, and cells were not much more than that. But what has been discovered over the last 50 or more years now, 70 years actually, is in a world of astounding complexity, of amazing nanotechnology that is actually the most complex that has been found anywhere in nature. And that is, how do you explain where that comes from? Because cells are the most simple life. Before cells, you don't have life. You know, there's, life that can exist on its own independently. You need a cell for that. So life must have started with a cell. But how do you get something as complex as a cell? This is a real question. I have a short video clip about that, where some scientists have been interviewed, and then there's a glimpse into the world of the cell, so we get an idea, actually, how complex a cell is. I mean, and that's just an idea, because it's just the top of the iceberg we're going to see.
He had an idea of the cell as being quite simple, correct?
Yeah, everybody did.
Yeah, okay. And if he thought of the cell as being a Buick, what is the cell now in terms of its complexity by comparison?
A galaxy.
If Darwin thought a cell was, say, a mud hut, what do we now know that a cell is?
More complicated than a Saturn V.
So what is in a cell? As far as we know now.
A world that Darwin never could have imagined.
I needed someone who could give me a glimpse into this world. So we went to molecular biologist Doug Axe.
Think of a cell as being a nanofactory. A factory where, on a very small scale, digital instructions are being used to make the components of the factory. Here we have the famous DNA double helix. You can see the two helical strands that are intertwined and wind around each other on the outside of the molecule. This is the material that stores all of our genetic information. In higher life forms, this would be the equivalent of something like a gigabyte of information stored in the molecules that form the individual chromosomes, all packed within the nucleus, which is a tiny fraction of the entire cell size. So what does DNA do? Well, the information in DNA ends up providing the information for sequencing the amino acids to make protein. We have information in a one-dimensional form that provides the information for a three-dimensional form.
Follow? And was it useful with Danish subtitles? I'm sorry. I should, anyway.
This is Danish or Swedish or what?
Danish. It was Danish. Subtitles were Danish. So I'm sorry that I didn't remove them for this presentation. But so, but that gives just an idea about what complexity we are talking about. Where does all this complexity come from? The plain answer is nobody knows. I mean, if you talk in terms of evolution, physics, chemistry, and that's all you know, that's the toolbox you want to explain with, well, you don't have the tools to explain it. That's also, you know, echoes what Prabhupada he said. The scientists must admit that they still do not know the origin of life. Their claim that they will soon prove a chemical origin of life is something like paying someone with a post-dated check. That's a famous quote. We all know that quote. So Prabhupada was right. They haven't, you know, they might claim we're going to do it in the future. That future has not come yet. I mean, no, this statement is bluffing. It's not a scientific statement, say that you'll do something in the future. And you find, you know, I could give you dozens of quotes, scientists actually admitting that. This is one. This is actually from 1998, but it's as true today as was 20 years ago. Today, as we leave the 20th century, we still face the biggest unsolved problem that we had when we entered the 20th century. How did life originate on Earth? This is another example. One professor wrote a book where one chapter was about the origin of life and the research into the origin of life. And he started the chapter saying, "This is a chapter about an abject scientific failure." At that time, they had been researching into the origin, chemical origin of life for 50 years, and it's just complete, total failure. They haven't found anything that indicates how it could have happened. Or another one, the chance of such reactions, referring to spontaneous formation of a molecule called RNA, should occur on the early Earth is vanishingly small. And so on. You can go on quoting like that. Really, when we talk about, in scientific terms, about theory of evolution, there is no theory. It doesn't exist.
It just happens?
Yeah, it's happened. There's a narrative. There's a story. You can say there's a narrative. But so, for example, the Bible has a narrative. God created him in 6 days and rested on the seventh. That's a narrative. Evolutionists, they have a narrative. But they don't have an actual theory. Theory is something that can possibly explain what needs to be explained, and you can test it. You can test it. We can have a theory, for example, water. I have a theory. It's a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen. Okay, so that's a theory. And then you can say, can you prove it? And then I'll take it to a laboratory, and I'll combine hydrogen and oxygen and say, just see, this is water. So, but there's not even a possible theory about what could be the origin of life or chemical composition of life. And there's what to speak of demonstrating it or proving or disproving it. It's not there.
Well, there should be a falsifiable statement.
Yeah.
If theory to deserve a status of theory should be
falsifiable.
Yeah, should be falsifiable, yeah. like that you can falsify a statement by an experiment, but according to this criteria, is evolution only a story? Like to say all the swans are white, and to find a black one, that's the scientific formulation, because you cannot prove the positive, you can only reject the negative, yeah. Actually. That's
yeah.
the...
Yeah.
Like but that this theory doesn't have this form, so automatically you can discard it.
And what you can formulate so it's falsifiable has been falsified.
Yeah.
This has been falsified, but it's not been admitted. It's not been admitted. That's if you look at it. It's really the whole evidence for it completely evaporates when you start looking at it. And it's been admitted. I have a couple of more quotes, and then I'm finished with this. This is a cell biologist from Oxford who wrote, "We should reject as a matter of principle the substitution of intelligent design for the dialogue of chance and necessity. But we must concede that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations. You know, he says there's only wishful speculations. We have no detailed accounts. So that's an interesting quote. Another, of course, it's also interesting that he says here, we should reject as a matter of principle intelligent design. Who said that? You know, he states like that. Another scientist here comments that this is a, you know, he's a fine Michael B. Everyone knows him, or he's a famous intelligent design theorist. So he wrote here commenting on this Professor Harrell's statement about intelligent design. Harrell's second point is that he apparently thinks there is some principle that forbids us from investigating intelligent design, even though design is an obvious idea that quickly pops into your mind when you see a drawing of the flagellum or other complex biochemical systems. I completely disagree with that view and find it faint-hearted. I think science should follow the evidence wherever it seems to lead. And there are scientists nowadays who, I mean, and that's been going on for the last 30 years, who come up openly as saying actually our, you know, biology points to intelligent design. Actually, already back in 1976, Richard Thompson, American mathematician, stated this, we'd like to argue that the chance of molecular forces theory won't explain things like this, but to say that there is an intelligent designer would be a sensible explanation. And you know Richard Thompson? Who doesn't know Richard Thompson? Yes, you know him?
He made this model where he proved that it would take too long time for natural selection to produce us. Mm-hmm. That's his...
He did that also. Yeah. But he's a disciple of Prabhupada. Uh-huh. He's a Prabhupada. Interesting. It's a presentation he gave to Prabhupada. This is a quote from a presentation to Prabhupada. So where we can see that, I mean, he's a, you know, real professional scientist. He's one of the most brilliant scientists that I've come across when you see his writings. Only briefly, on a padayatra once in Mayapur, Parikram, he was there walking under a black umbrella, and you know, in amongst, and I was quite new that I tried to go up and speak to him, but he said yes, no, and then he just said, so I never had a chance to talk to him.
When was that? How long ago?
The Parikram?
Yeah.
Oh. 86 or no, not 86. There was no Parikram. Could be 89. Could be 92. Something like that. So he never came where I was. Otherwise, I mean, I listened to a lot of his lectures. I read all his books and so on. And he's really the one who has, like, this presentation I've given, this book I've written, is really based on, you can say, the outline of his arguments. This is the outline that he presented for arguing against evolution. That's it for this one. Microphone.
But I find interesting, you were mentioning that if there are productive positive mutations, then they appear at lower level of complexity with these microbes. You were saying that they are mutating, they develop resistance to some antibiotics.
Antibiotics, for example, yeah.
But then in the presentation, you were funny thing you were mentioning that it also happens that in so-called similar manner, more complex organisms like we develop the same kind of resistance. Mm-hmm. So the first statement taken alone alone would be kind of an argument. If that's true, then complex organisms cannot develop because the less complex would destroy them at the. But then you speak against that with this other. Yeah, yeah. If you can comment.
I didn't say that mutations that can be fabled in complex organisms cannot happen. I said, but complex traits cannot happen when it takes. If a trait can be achieved by one mutation, then it's very likely it will happen. If it takes two simultaneous mutation, then it becomes less likely, but it can happen. If it takes three simultaneous mutation, then it's extremely rare. Four, forget it. That will not happen. But there are examples. For example, more complex forms, like for example, there are certain species of fish who have developed antifreeze proteins in their blood, so they can live in the Arctics and Antarctics. And that can be seen. That looks like that could happen by mutation and gradual selection, like that.
But that in itself doesn't speak against the existence of God.
No. Obviously there is a certain flexibility and adaptability in species. You know, it's like humans. We can live in the tropics. We can live here. We can even live in very cold climate. Of course, we dress, but also like if we got accustomed to it, we wouldn't like. As far as I know, when the original humans living in the tip of South America. In the Fuego de Tierra, is that called? Tierra del Fuego. That's in southern South America. People used to live naked there, without clothes, and that's very cold. So we can. There's a flexibility and adaptability in species. That's not a. And even if. If species, they do change into other species, I mean, that doesn't argue against the existence of God. Even if some, you know, the whole thing started with one original life form, that still doesn't necessarily exclude the idea of God. So on one level, we don't even have to argue on that. But just the science points to that that's not what's happening. I mean, it happens within what you can call microevolution. And where, you know, what are the limits? What are the, you know, that can be argued. But the real, you know, big, you know, really big evolution, macroevolution, that doesn't seem to happen. But that's not really the issue that we're talking about anyway. Darwin's main, you know, thing that we are contending is that everything can happen naturally, and we can show there are things that cannot happen naturally, and that's all you need. You don't have to show that nothing can happen naturally. Of course, there are things that do happen naturally, but if you just point out one thing that cannot be explained naturally, then the whole theory is exploded actually. Michael?
Hare Krishna. Why do you think the devotees are not more involved in this area of research or...
Good question.
Yeah, why do you think the devotees... Or if I put it the other way, my perception is, I'm also from the scientific background, and which area of science is needed that you can really argue, you know, because many of these arguments are really, I mean, they're not really scientific. I mean, I mean, like proved by it. Okay, Sadhguru was a mathematician, but which field of science covers this area? Oh. Or probably there are multidisciplinary sciences. It's not cellular biology or what is your understanding?
Actually, one point, I mean, anyone who has some scientific training can get himself into this and understand it. But many devotees don't have a scientific background, so it's difficult for them to even to read scientific papers and like that. So that's, you know, many excluded from that. But the field that you need to understand, actually, mathematics, statistics, and physics, that's actually quite essential to understand that, because it's, the claim is that biology can be reduced to chemistry, and chemistry can be then be reduced to physics, and physics can be reduced to mathematics. Biologists, unfortunately, are generally not mathematicians and physics. For them, often it seems very plausible, yes, it can happen by physical processes, because they are not physicists. So at least that I've seen often. So I mean, of course, to completely get into the whole field, you have to. It's a quite transdisciplinary. You have to know about, you know, aside from physics, chemistry, mathematics, molecular biology, chemistry, and you have to also. I mean, of course, biology in general, geology. And paleontology, you know, study of ancient life, fossils, fossil studies, and like that is also. To argue in this field, you have to. This is, I'd say, these are the fields you have to be familiar with.
So this area is domain of which disciplinary?
It's
biologists who are the owner of this theory. Which field? Are you just like a wag?
It's a
general science.
There's not one specialized branch of science. Of course, they would say evolutionary biology, but to really be specialist, you have to have knowledge in all these fields. So it's a little transdisciplinary.
Yes, because my experience when I was in research field, when you go deeper into the details.
Yeah.
There is an obvious need that it's so complex that only you only own or you perceive only one perspective. For example, I was doing in the field of material science.
Yeah.
You know, like we're starting with like wear or friction, but when you go in details, then you see okay, this is a lot of complexity here, and many other fields like chemistry or, you know, nanotechnology. So many other fields are there involved that you as a singular discipline, you cannot explain properly.
No.
And here in this area also see, my perception is that when you go to, when this complexity was shown, I mean, Haribol, how can you deal with this? I mean, this is really similar in the other fields. When you go in details, it's complex like anything.
Yeah.
So it's probably my understanding that the probably a group of scientists or groups of scientists will be needed. I mean, devotees who will have like a holistic presentation to refute. From the biological point of view, from mathematical point of view, chemistry point, evolutionist, anthropologist, theological, that would probably have bigger impact. Because you just say, from mathematical point, biologists will laugh or will ignore you. If you go from this side, it's not holistic. You will miss some perspective which one will not accept.
Yeah.
Make this sense?
Yeah, no, I understand the point. And of course, the problem is, and then when you become specialized, you lose the complete overview.
That's why you need the group.
Yeah.
You need a teamwork of scientists who can really debate on it.
And then you need someone on top of that who actually have the And you need actually a polyhistor. Have you heard that expression?
Polyhistor.
But
yeah, but that doesn't exist anymore.
No, it used to be.
Used to be.
Like for example, I had a quote from Professor Agassiz in 1857. He was a polyhistor. Yeah. He was a specialist in
many
fields at the same time. but still, you can be I'd say specialized in evolution and arguing against evolution, like for example I'm doing. I'm not claiming to be a great specialist on anything actually, and as I think I'm not a researcher. I've not done anything original research ever, and I don't think I need to because I think it's already been done. But I'm collecting from those who are specialists from their particular fields, and even from others who have collected and put it together. I'm collecting from them and then giving presentation from there.
So how do you see then devotee's role in this area? Because if there is some individual attempt, probably will be not be so.
No.
Will be not be. That's why probably Prabhupada was so eager to introduce this Bhaktivedanta Institute, so that the collective endeavor of many devotee scientists can really have impact on this field.
Yeah.
But different point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
This is my perception how could work. I'm not saying that it's worked, but still.
But also, I mean, theory of evolution claims to be a total theory. But if you can just point even to one place where it can be shown that it's wrong, the whole theory deflates like a balloon. You just pick one hole, then it's finished. So. And that is, I think, is not so difficult.
But still, general science doesn't. Even there are arguments which are in that level.
Yeah.
General science or general perception till the government level doesn't take place, right? Even though there's so many arguments against, still is valid.
Yeah, but if you look at that's I haven't. That could be one
still
of the.
Still, it's taught in the schools, right?
Yeah.
It's not that. So how that will be moved?
There, actually, you're moving outside this field of hard science, and you actually start looking more at sociology and politics, and how a certain ideology is being promoted and other things are being suppressed. This is lot of what goes on. But I have in other slide presentation where I look at the arguments that is given in favor of evolution. Now I gave arguments against evolution, and I could give many more. This is just a little sample of what is there. But then also they give and they write books. Dawkins and others, they write books. These are the evidences and this proof of evolution. So then I have something on, so what is it that, what do you use as proofs or evidence of evolution? The evidence actually turned out to be quite weak or non-existent. And it comes really down to it that, no, God would not have done it like that. Sensible God would not create like that. They'll see this is, this is not very good design. A good, creator would not create like that. But when you start arguing like that, then you're really out of the, out of science. This is theology.
Yeah, right.
This is theology. So this is our field. They're really out of their field. They will claim that fossils prove evolution, but actually, no. First of all, fossils cannot prove evolution. They can, at most, they can be shown to be in harmony with evolution, but you cannot prove evolution by fossils. Because how can you go to a graveyard, you dig up some bones, how can you tell just by anatomy who was, father and who was son and who was related? You cannot. So fossils, the fossils do not contradict the theory of evolution, but it turns out they do fossils actually violently contradicts the idea of gradual evolution. Or they have you've seen the examples where they compare embryos to each other.
Yes.
That's one.
All one is completely fake.
Yeah, so it turns out it's fake. It's completely fake. But maybe one of the other days I can show you a number of arguments in favor of evolution. Because also, when it turns down, they don't have that expert. You're talking about who has a particular field. That expert is that field is not really there. Because you include many, many fields. And it's really more often also, you know, philosophy and theology is also involved in that. Plus, politics and economical pressure. There's for example, if you speak out against evolution in many universities, you lose your job if you're a professor. So what do you do about that? That means many are not speaking out. They're thinking, but they don't speak out, and they cannot speak out. But it's a multidisciplinary thing, and you have to. I'm not super expert, but I've had to get familiarized with a number of fields, and not being an expert means. Then I draw on those who actually are experts.
Sure, sure.
That's
get the complete picture.
Yeah.
Different
yeah.
perspective.
This, yeah.
is, this is actually what is the most successful areas are like that. They are combining different areas together. So
yeah.
this is how to integrate different
yeah.
perspectives then yeah. and make a new perspective, which is holistic.
Yeah.
This is how most successful disciplinary are works like
yeah.
that. Yeah,
yeah. And but then also a question is, how much do we have to demonstrate? And because who has the burden of proof? I know one devotee who is very much into it also, but he kind of shoots himself in the foot because he assumes too much a burden of proof that I don't think is necessary. He says we have to be able to demonstrate that there's no way possible that life could arise chemically. But how will you show that? That is, there's absolutely no way that life could arise chemically. So I'd say, but that's wrong thinking. They have to show that life can arise chemically in order to, have that theory accepted. It's not that we have to demonstrate, so that's a philosophical point, or you can say, epistemological point, who actually has the burden of proof?
Mm.
So when you find out that the burden of proof is with the evolutionists, then our job becomes a lot easier.
We can prove that life came from life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 And... and...
So,
and we can show that's... probably what I'll show tomorrow. We talked about that in the morning. I'll continue because it will be the same, or there'll be more.
More, but it's recorded. So it's
okay. So, I'll actually get into design detection. We talk about intelligent design. How do we actually conclude that a thing is designed, as opposed to it just arose by some natural process?
Yeah, because this is the main line, actually, no?
Yeah.
Where you can figure out, what is truth or not. When yeah. you say when it's designed, when it's not designed.
Yeah. And it turns out that life have the symptoms of being designed, the same symptoms that you use in other contexts to conclude design, because design is not, you conclude that in many contexts. And there you have certain criteria. And when you apply the same criteria to biology, it also says design. So that means, in one sense, the default position is design, because the criteria you use in other contexts, which are not being contested, they also turn out, they also indicate there's design in biology. So I say the default position is design. And that's why scientists previously, they were concluding there was design, there's God behind. Because it's, you know, like for example, we're sitting here in a room, and we know that it's not a mountain cave, a naturally formed room. This is a designed room we're in. If someone would argue, no, this was actually happened by some natural process, he would have to prove it. It's not that we have to, you know. The default position is this is a designed room. So life are, you know, by design, you know, by default, we must conclude is design. So someone claims otherwise, like Darwin claims, well, he has the burden of proof to actually demonstrate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What they teach in the school?
Huh?
What they teach in the school?
What
is the teaching in the school, in the university, what they teach?
Evolution?
They teach Darwinism?
Darwinism, evolution. Yes. Yeah, they're standard. You can go and open biology books and they'll just give you the whole narrative of evolution.
Neo-Darwinist.
When you get down to talk about mechanism, you know, then they'll propose neo-Darwinism.
But they don't say neo-Darwinism, just say...
Some do. Sometimes they use them interchangeably. It's called Darwinism, they actually mean neo-Darwinism. Sometimes they use the word neo-Darwinism. Sometimes they're called the synthesis, new synthesis. That's another word, technical word for it. Neo-Darwinism was mainly constructed in the 1930s and around that time it was called the new synthesis, combining genetics with the natural selection idea. Okay, thank you very much.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.